You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also chat with us on Twitter by going to twitter.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This performance of cellist Mieczysław Rostropowicz before the falling Berlin Wall in 1989 is one of the most famous examples of an artist confronting forces of repression and dictatorship. There have been many since, less well-known, and with unhappier outcomes. This hour, we explore the dissonance you often hear when you listen to the messages from artists and diplomats about how to confront people trapped in wartime. We'll have an assessment of the U.S. policy in Syria and how it might be failing, and then later in the hour, an artist who believes the world has failed the people of Syria. He grapples with what is the responsibility of artists in this conflict. Also, the public health problem of heroin and its synthetic imitators and the open door of the internet and who can get into the broadband world and why and who can't get in. But first, is it back to square one in Syria? In a closed-door meeting with Secretary of State John Kerry and Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, Kerry said he's lost faith in U.S. Syria policy, according to the senators, very much at odds with this statement from the president in his State of the Union speech last week.
American diplomacy, backed by the threat of force, is why Syria's chemical weapons are being eliminated. And we will continue to work with the international community to usher in the future the Syrian people deserve, a future free of dictatorship, terror, and fear.
Today it is clear that the chemical weapons eradication is stalled. There have been days of heavy bombing in Aleppo, and al-Qaeda increasingly seems to have the upper hand in the Syrian opposition. Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, joins me now. She's currently distinguished visiting scholar at the University of North Florida. Nancy, welcome back to the program.
Hello.
So how would you assess this, you know, report that John Kerry apparently has lost faith in U.S. policy, and just assessing the policy generally, where do we stand?
Well, I suspect that privately President Obama is having the same feelings. I think actually the chemical weapons piece is going to work. It's apparently hard to remove chemical weapons in the middle of a Syrian war, but that is not going to end the terror, intimidation, and chaos and the deaths that you see in Syria. You've got well over 100,000. And on the course that we're on right now, you're going to see another 100,000. The extremists are on the rise. So it's absolutely essential that we step back and say, where is this all going? It's not headed in the right direction.
Lindsey Graham and John McCain have long been critics of U.S. policy in Syria, and they've also been generally fairly hawkish about dealing with nations like Syria. They certainly were pretty hawkish in the Libyan conflict. Do they have a solution here? Do they have an alternative policy, or are they just carping on the sidelines?
Well, I think they're just carping on the sidelines. The more interesting alternative is one that was put forward by two distinguished diplomats, Tom Pickering and Frank Wisner, last week, saying we need to think about who is the enemy here. Is it the Assad regime or is it the rebel groups? And that perhaps we ought to think of it as a necessary evil to deal with the Assad regime, focus on ousting the rebels that are increasingly prevalent here. And that's re-energized an entire debate in Washington about what we should do. If you step back and look at what's happened here, there was euphoria when the Arab Spring started, an assumption that one Arab dictator would fall after another. President Obama said Assad must go, but there's never been a plan to make him go. And he's clear that he's made it clear he's not going voluntarily, particularly with the strong support of the Iranians and the Russians, and fairly weak support from us, even the Saudis, for the opposition. The government continues to have strong staying power. The president's threat of the use of force over the chemical weapons did have an impact and is the only reason that the chemical weapons are on their way out. But we never backed up the diplomacy on getting Assad out with the use of force. And that's why you see the stalemate that we have today. Now, whether it's too late to do that now and we're going to have to deal with Assad, that's the big question that the administration and from President Obama on down, I think, not just John Kerry, is now grappling with. And there are no good solutions left in Syria.
But let's explore the details of this alternative you outlined that comes from Ambassador Pickering. That would be, in a sense, making a deal with the devil, Mr. Assad, to secure Syria in terms of al-Qaeda, which, if anything, has been the real beneficiary of all of this stalemate. They've been strengthened in Syria. They've been able to create a kind of pan-Arabic Islamist movement, or at least the appearance of one. Is there a way militarily to go into Syria with Assad's backing and secure Syria against al-Qaeda attacks launched from the Middle East?
Well, to do that, you'd have to have a huge multinational force in Syria and the cooperation of the Iranians and the Saudis, who are the main backers of the two sides here. And I don't see that coming anytime soon. I think a more likely scenario is an agreement between the rebels and the United States that we're not going to overthrow the Assad regime, and that they're going to have to deal with the Assad regime and begin to use the negotiations to effectively get a ceasefire and a stalemate while things simmer down. That is very unlikely as well. The other alternative is to drastically increase support to the rebels and empower them to overthrow the Syrian regime. And that will be a very bloody, long drawn out civil war with probably 300,000 more dead. So we're so far into this right now, 3 years into this bloody conflict, the choices are more and more narrow and the downsides are increasingly difficult. I think what you're likely to see is something close to what the Pickering-Wisner approach was, and hold our nose and say, all right, we're going to have to deal with this regime, and what are our real interests here? And that's very different than where we were when the administration and President Obama himself said that Assad must go. And that's an ugly reality that I think is increasingly emerging.
How does the hold your nose scenario keep Assad from basically having a victory parade in the streets of Damascus?
Well, right now, there are no safe streets to have a parade on, so I think that that's unlikely. But in the symbolism of him remaining and the U.S. dealing with him is very unpleasant. And I think the problem with the current U.S. policy is there's no road to success. So Obama either has to dramatically increase support to the rebels, who are increasingly fractured, although al-Qaeda apparently has now distancing itself from the Syrian Islamists, but we'll see how that evolves. And I think Obama has a very tough choice. Do we agree that we're not going to get rid of Assad and try and make the best out of the broken eggs that are left on the table? Or do we really say, all right, he has to go? And I don't see them dramatically increasing the aid to the opposition, nor do I see them imposing a no-fly zone, which would limit the ability of Assad to bomb his own people. There are really no good choices here left. And it's partly because we've never had a coherent strategy from the beginning. The one victory that Obama can point to, which he did in the State of the Union, is the chemical weapons will leave Syria. There's very little doubt about that. There'll be glitches and problems, but I think that will happen. But that's not the majority cause of the deaths on the streets of Syria. So Obama has some tough choices to make. I think Secretary Kerry's right to say, let's look at where we are on this. And the international community really has to decide, is it going to insist that we overthrow Assad, which is what it will take, as Western powers participating in that effort, along with the Saudis? Or do we say, let's just pause, see if we can get a ceasefire, at least stop the humanitarian crisis that's going on while we work out the politics on the side? No good choices here are left. And it's an unfortunate situation that we haven't had strong leadership on a policy that was put in place 2 years ago to get rid of Assad, and now we're stuck with dealing with him. So it's up to President Obama to come up with the least distasteful of the very unpleasant options on the table.
Just here at the end, I don't often ask you questions like this, but if you found yourself face-to-face with a family in Aleppo, what would you tell them about their future? What would you tell them about the possibility that anything could end what it is they're going through?
I would tell them to get out of the country. No question about it. It's not safe, and particularly the children that are being killed. There's 9.5 million people that have been displaced from their home, and that's going to just continue. I would not advise anyone to stay in Aleppo. We need to do more on the humanitarian front. We need to get humanitarian corridors to make sure that those people who are still at risk can get out. And that's why it's so urgent to stop the violence. It's why people are starting to think anew about what is the real interest in Syria, and do we need to, number one, stop the carnage, and number two, think about the politics. And I think that's the flip that you're seeing happening on the world stage.
Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, currently distinguished visiting scholar at the University of North Florida. Thanks as always, Nancy.
My pleasure.
From diplomat to the sound of someone who didn't want to but finally had to leave Syria, composer, clarinet virtuoso, Kenan Azmeh.
You know, you get up in the morning here in New York, the day has already passed in Damascus, you know, we're seven hours after. And, you know, the first thing you do, you open your computer and you hear the terrible news coming from home. So it became really a sad morning every morning. Am I able to really experience what they do experience on the ground? Of course not. But that's the way I can react to it. That's the only thing I can do. You know, I took time of silence for a year before I was able to write music again, because I was questioning the role of the artist, the role of music, if music can stop a single bullet at any time. Of course it doesn't, but what it can do is it can inspire. It's also some kind of therapy also for me to just be able to, you know, to speak out, because I think music is an act of freedom by default in a way.
Music as an answer, but not a solution to the horrors of war, the agony and ecstasy of Syrian composer Kenan Azmeh later this hour. Coming up next, in another war, the enemy has acquired some powerful allies. Heroin, with its synthetic opioid prescription cousins, is killing and enslaving people at rates double compared to just a few years ago. Philip Seymour Hoffman, the actor, is just one casualty in a new scourge of fatalities. We asked you for your views on the nature of addiction. Pryor, Oklahoma, we don't battle addiction. Addiction is inherent in us all. Battles are won and lost. Addiction is never simply lost. We educate ourselves about hard drugs, same as soft, caffeine, alcohol, etc. We accept the reality of their threat to a healthy life and how they affect us all in different ways. I am a former user of heroin. I'm a healthy working adult. No one would ever think I was using when I was, nor that I would have been a user in the past.
Hi, my name is Terry. I'm calling from Sebring, Florida. The way I see it is addiction is just a nicer way of saying a lack of will. I'm a smoker, and my addiction is my unwillingness to quit. Many people quit smoking drugs every day, those who want to, of course. And I've been around druggies my life. My wife worked at a drug rehab facility in Kentucky. It can be done, but it's only if they want to.
We treasure your insights at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at facebook.com/thetakeaway. We'll continue our look at the heroin epidemic after the break.
I caught you knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby, can I have some more? Ooh, the damage done.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In Miami-Dade County, 36 dead. Twin Cities, 54 dead. Cleveland metro area, 16. The pastoral state of Vermont has the same problem, and it's not from eating too much Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
In every corner of our state, heroin and opiate drug addiction threatens us. It threatens the safety that has always blessed our little state.
Vermont Governor Pete Shumlin on Vermont Public Radio delivering his State of the State address last month. Heroin deaths are on the rise all over America. And none of the statistics I cited from the last few years involve a brilliant, famous Hollywood actor like Philip Seymour Hoffman, whose death hit the headlines over the weekend. Heroin has found powerful allies in synthetic prescription drugs made to imitate opium-derived narcotics, We turn now to Dr. Anand Veeravagut, senior neurosurgery resident at Stanford University School of Medicine and former special assistant to the Secretary of Defense. Doctor, welcome.
Hi, John. It's great to be here. Thank you.
So tell me about your sense of the scale of this problem and how the intersection of heroin and prescription drugs may be amplifying it.
Well, John, over the last decade or so, we've seen tight regulations surrounding prescription drugs, specifically oxycodone, OxyContin, and other opioid derivatives that are very similar to heroin. As we have tighter and tighter controls, which I think are rightfully so, on the distribution of prescription drugs, we find that people are turning to other alternatives that are a whole lot cheaper. For example, heroin that is laced with various other chemicals. And so the last decade has been extraordinarily unpredictable because laid on top of the idea that prescription drug use is changing in the United States is the reality that opium production is increasing in different parts of the world, whether it be in Afghanistan or in Latin America. And so the geopolitics of production of opium and various other heroin-like substances in combination with more strict controls of prescription meds has really changed and unfortunately made the landscape of drug abuse unpredictable in the United States.
Is there something more fatal about a heroin laced with a prescription drug or a prescription drug derivative?
Absolutely. And the term that's coming to bear in recent time is the idea of polydrug toxicity. And that is when you use one substance, for example, pure heroin, the side effects of such are a little bit more predictable than what would be the case if you were to take what may be heroin and have it laced with something like fentanyl, which is actually an opioid drug that's available by prescription and usually used in the hospital and is 100 times stronger than morphine. And so that's what we actually saw on the East Coast in Philadelphia just last week is we had a series of deaths related to the use of multiple drugs at the same time. Now, it's often alcohol that's combined with heroin that leads to unfortunate demise. But what we're seeing now is that the actual intravenous drug itself is being mixed with other drugs. And you have this polydrug toxicity that is completely unpredictable. And that's probably what is responsible, I think, in many cases for the increasing number of deaths that we're seeing.
You know, the other thing that you describe here, and it's really the public health nightmare, and you and others are going to have to deal with it, is the fact that the prescription drug opioid revolution, which has been so effective in dealing with palliative care in end-stage cancer and other places, has also unwittingly, I suppose, become a gateway drug for people in all socioeconomic levels who find themselves, when they can't get the prescription drug, really candidates to become heroin users.
Oh, gosh, John, I think you've hit the nail right on the head. Unfortunately, we see opioid prescription drug abuse in all sectors of society. And sort of in our clinical practice, we end up seeing addiction of all types. And heavy regulation on oxycodone, OxyContin, and as you may have heard, Vicodin was actually just taken off the market. I think is reasonable, and I think it's much needed because it prevents a lot of these pills from getting on the street. The trouble is, as you mentioned, they're very strong. They're very good at preventing and helping pain in terminally ill patients, maybe like cancer patients or chronic pain patients. At the same time, their addictive profile is extraordinarily powerful. And so I think that's probably why we're seeing a lot of people turning towards cheaper forms of the drugs, such as heroin and heroin laced with other drugs. And it's something that we have to control at the level of the healthcare system and also when thinking about how to deal with chronic pain. And I think medicine is making that change and we're headed in that direction. But because we aren't there yet, we're seeing a lot of what we're seeing sort of on the streets of our country.
Finally, have you ever encountered a case where someone who is used to taking opioid derivatives orally, right? And most of them are delivered orally, correct?
They are. That's right.
Yep. Who develop an addiction to that prescription drug who would never under any circumstances consider IV drugs, but because the addiction is so powerful and they're unable to get the oral opioids, shift into becoming an IV drug user.
I have seen that, and I think that's unfortunately an all too common story amongst our youth in particular. And what ends up happening is the addiction demand and the drive is so strong, and the ability to obtain narcotics will eventually expire. Once you've demonstrated addictive behavior, usually your physician or healthcare provider will start initiating discussions about how we could potentially change to non-narcotic-based pain medications, whether it's using behavioral therapy, acupuncture, or medications that don't involve an addiction pathway. And sometimes we'll have patients that may see that coming, and they can't tolerate it, they're not willing to challenge the idea that they can break their addiction, or they're scared. And in that situation, we do have patients that may turn to the IV form of the drug that's available on the streets. And that's really scary for us. That is the person that we want to capture and make sure we prevent that transition as soon as possible. And it's sometimes just very hard to identify them. I wish there was a way we could predict who would be more likely to transition to an IV drug situation. But unfortunately, we just haven't gotten to the point where we can predict with accuracy who those people are. But I can assure you that once we get there, we will hopefully prevent a lot of our patients from transitioning over to illegal drug use.
Some scary public health questions there being asked by Dr. Anand Viravago, who's a senior neurosurgery resident at Stanford University School of Medicine, former special assistant to the Secretary of Defense. Doctor, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John. Thank you for having me.
Strength and power of addiction. You have some thoughts on that. Fort Lauderdale, or Florida, each individual addict needs to find their own path, rehab, cure. Unfortunately, there's not a one-size-fits-all solution. What works for some may fail miserably for others. Recovery is a tough road and a never-ending battle. Thanks for that. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And there's much more on all this and everything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Capitol Hill now, and the big mystery, is the GOP of one mind or more than one mind on the question of immigration reform, and is progress possible in this Congress? Some positive signs, also some negative signs coming out of Washington. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillig is with us. Thanks for joining us, Todd.
Hi, John.
So the GOP seems to be getting a lot of urging from folks on the outside and some within the party to go slow on immigration reform. But there are some leaders who really want to accomplish something, and Speaker John Boehner seems to be one of them.
He does, and so does the rest of the House Republican leadership. Look, it was a couple of weeks ago when we mentioned that immigration might have a pulse. Now I'm here to tell you that the patient is actually breathing on its own. Doesn't mean it doesn't have a long way to go, and it's probably not going to pass anytime soon. But here's what happened just sort of over the weekend and before as Republicans gathered for their private issues summit. Republicans only, no outsiders, press kept at bay. Some principles on immigration reform released by the House Republican leadership. Some of them will sound familiar, and some of them will sound a lot like this, like the bill that the Senate passed last summer. Things like border security, a visa system, an entry-exit system, verification to make sure that employers aren't hiring illegal people. And that all might sound familiar. Now, of course, you're already thinking to yourself, sure, I know about that. But what about citizenship for 11,000 undocumented immigrants? And that is where Republicans, House Republicans and Tea Party Republicans and Senate Democrats might still be far, far apart.
Even though the president seems to have offered a compromise on that path to citizenship for illegal immigrants?
He may have. And this is where we don't know, because everyone's language is typically soft and gushy. Here's what House Republicans said. House Republicans said there must be no special pathway to citizenship for any illegals living in the country currently. I'm going to repeat that. No special path to citizenship. They said anyone here illegally could stay if they pay fines, admit what they did, learn English, pay back taxes, and do a whole bunch of penalties. So you say, well, geez, they don't want citizenship for any of those people. Although, there's another way to interpret that language, and this is what House Democrats and the president even are hopeful that House Republicans may mean or may be able to come around to in the event of a negotiation, and it's this. Special path, well, you might say the Senate bill has a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, but it's not special. It's actually under current law. You just have to go to the back of the line and really wait 13 years to become a citizen. So what do House Republicans mean, John? They don't even know yet. This is the language that gets the conversation started.
And, you know, it's many layers. You add a layer. That's how you pretend to make progress. It's no longer amnesty. It's no longer a special pathway, which is different from amnesty. And the legal matter actually doesn't accomplish much for illegal immigrants, but it might constitute a fig leaf for Republicans who can at least sign up for some form of pathway to citizenship without conceding on the amnesty question.
Well, this is the politics of big, difficult issues, especially in an election year. Does it accomplish something for illegal immigrants? It might. It means that the policy of the United States won't be to deport them any longer. You know who it might mean something big for? People called the Dreamers, people involved in the Dream Act, young people who came to this country via their parents when they were little. Even Republicans agree now that those folks, they agree with Democrats and with the president. Those folks should be able to become citizens. John, I want to make one point. When could this all happen? Could it happen sometime soon? We're in an election year. Listen to Greg Walden of Oregon right now, if you would, please.
When you lay out a major policy initiative like immigration, I don't know when it's going to appear on the schedule. My hunch is it doesn't come up, you know, tomorrow. It's probably months out.
And redistricting is the evil doer here in the sense that there are a lot of Republicans in safe districts where immigration isn't an issue and a lot of them where it is a big issue, and that's the division.
John, Greg Walden is in charge of getting House Republicans reelected. He's the money guy, and he knows that this issue has to come after the primaries. That's important.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Growth of the web has meant that governing the gigantic global community that uses it has become a technological and social and civic challenge for institutions that in some cases almost accidentally ended up playing the role of masters of the universe, such as the case for the institution ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. ICANN has begun the largest expansion ever in generic top-level domains, or GTLDs. That means that .com, .org, and .edu will now share space on the web with all kinds of new addresses like .build, .college, .wedding. But there is tension in this new world. Michael Frumkin is a professor of law at the University of Miami. He believes ICANN has been too heavy-handed in its control of the new domains, while Cyrus Namazi, vice president of domain name system services at ICANN, says it's an exciting, brave new world.
There's really no hierarchy being designed into the new rollout of the expansion program. So what you're going to see is, as an example, New York City is going to have a .nyc top-level domain. So most people then will be able to identify the programs that the city offers for its citizens, for its tourism programs, and so on and so forth. People who are looking for information for City of New York, for instance, will be assured that it's actually a legitimate website they're going to because it's going to be managed by the City of New York.
Does this create a brand protection problem, though, Michael Frumkin, in the sense that now you've got 120 different Disneys out there potentially, and that people could much more easily copy, or that businesses and brands that need to be protected have to acquire all of these domains as well?
Well, if you're a very large, what we call famous mark, then of course you have an interest in doing that. But that's no different from anything else we create, whether it's local signage, street naming, magazines, or anything else. I mean, that's just part of life in the trademark world. If I may, I'd like to go back to the issue about price, because I think that's actually very important. It's not obvious that this is going to create the kind of price competition we might have hoped for, in part because the barriers to entry into getting into the new GTLD program were very high. Most of the estimates I've seen put the total cost that it took from soup to nuts to get a domain name approved at about $1 million. That's really high.
That is really high. Why would it be so high?
I can try to address that perhaps. So the expansion of the top-level domain name within the internet hierarchy is a substantial undertaking, both from a logistics perspective, from a technical perspective, from a policy perspective. Also, running a top-level domain name requires an entity to have both financial means as well as the credentials and credibility of the people that run it so that they can be trusted with a license to operate that TLD.
How do you evaluate that, though? I mean, what do you do when somebody applies for a domain name that is obviously critical of someone or something, even insulting almost?
Sure. So the program actually took about 6 years of thinking and the community coming together and evaluating and investigating all different pitfalls and benefits and pros and cons of it. There is substantial due diligence that's done for each particular application before it's allowed to proceed forward toward becoming live on the internet.
I really want to challenge the assumption both of you are operating under, which is that ICANN has any business doing that at all. And to its credit, most of the time it's tried to avoid doing that. And this was sort of an exception. I'm very supportive of the idea of expanding the number of GTLDs. I mean, some of us have been arguing for this since before ICANN even existed. But the way that it's been done, ICANN inserted itself into the process. And instead of passing on the technical and perhaps financial bona fides and resiliency of the applicants, also wanted to pass on the strings, the names, as to whether they were proper or not. And I don't think that was a good idea.
So you believe complete free speech, totally open source, unregulated domain names?
Well, largely, yeah. I mean, there are some limits. You don't want misleading ones where it looks or sounds too much like one that's already there. So I think there absolutely is a gatekeeping function for keeping out those sort of semi-fraudulent attempts.
So, Cyrus, a brave new world, exciting new world, or sort of cautious steps? And you get the last word here.
It's absolutely a brave new world. What's taking place here, John, is a brand new blank canvas for people, for businesses, for special interests, for communities to come together, put a stake into the ground, have their identity in the virtual world identified with their special interests. It's absolutely thrilling.
Cyrus Namazi and Michael Frumkin, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Cyrus Namazi, Vice President of Domain Name System Services at ICANN. And Michael Frumkin is a professor of law at the University of Miami. So in contrast to the entrepreneurs greedily snapping up new domain names, there are huge communities, digitally speaking, that remain in the dark in America. Pew Research Center's Internet Project reports that among households with incomes of 30 grand or less, only 54% have access to broadband at home. One-third of those making less than $20,000 a year do not go online at all. But sometimes, deep in the poorest neighborhoods, you can get a signal.
Sometimes I do my homework and play games.
That's 10-year-old Natasha in the Bronx, pirating off a signal from Bernie Williams and Joshua Stevenson, who operate one of the city's housing authority Wi-Fi vans that circulate in underserved neighborhoods, encouraging little pirates to log on.
These are our two jetpack MiFis. It has 10 stations on each MiFi. So basically, we have four on each, and then we have the available slots for people when they come to want to connect their mobile devices to the network. And we also have a printer scanner right here. Basically, if people need to come in, we've had that too, where people need to come in and make copies, and we have that available to them as well.
Those voices, courtesy of our friends at WNYC New Tech City podcast. Wireless internet isn't a necessity for the poor, but after food, shelter, and clothing, it is a doorway to a better life, especially for school children, who increasingly rely on the internet for schoolwork and interactions with fellow students and teachers. In Kansas City, Missouri, Michael Limata has dedicated his life to the concept of internet for all. He's the co-founder and president of the nonprofit organization Connecting for Good. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So you really see this edge of people who have connectivity and people who don't, and in many cases the school children who really suffer by not having access to the internet when so many of their school friends actually do have it. What does that look like?
Well, here in Kansas City, the Kansas City Public School District, 70% of the children do not have internet at home. So it puts them at a tremendous disadvantage academically.
Now, do smartphones pick up the slack here? Is there a proliferation of smartphones in some of these communities? They're not cheap either.
You know, the adoption rate among urban core residents is just about the same as it is for suburbanites as far as smartphones go. However, we know that serious academic and even educational pursuits can't happen on a smartphone. To write essays and reports, and to do any serious academic activity, you really need a keyboard and a full screen.
Do libraries constitute an option for low-income folks, or is it really a matter of building a fundamentally new infrastructure for people within the city limits?
You know, the libraries, you may go and wait for 2 hours to use the computer for 45 minutes because you've got a whole lot of people waiting behind you. Even in the idea of building community computing centers is fine, but there are many neighborhoods where you don't want kids out after dark. So we believe that only in-home access is the key.
And what about in-home appliances? I mean, you may have the internet access, but the question is, do you actually have a computer? Are these kinds of things on a subsidized basis available to low-income families with school kids?
Yes, well, again, our organization Connecting for Good has a threefold approach. First, we're using wireless mesh networks to bring low-income people internet in places like public housing and low-income communities. We also have a computer refurbishing program where we can sell a low-income family a computer for as low as $50. And we require people to take two classes that we call digital life skills before we sell them a computer. So we're trying to hit it up at all different angles here to make sure that connectivity is possible.
Do you have a story of a family whose life has been changed by some of the kinds of things that you're able to set up for them?
Well, definitely. I think, you know, one of the things that we know is when it comes to employment, 70% of Fortune 500 companies require online applications. So we have a young lady who sought a job for over a year, the traditional means by calling and visiting. But when we got her a computer and connected, helped her with her resume, she got two job interviews and enrolled in online college to finish her degree in the first month after receiving help from us. We have many other stories of people who've gone out and completed their GED. And, you know, for many parents, it's just a great thing to be able to say, hey, I know where my kids are at night. They're working on the computer.
And who funds you? And it sounds like you believe that this really should be a broader statewide or citywide civic responsibility of a government to deliver.
Well, I think, you know, it's a big thing. When you have tens of thousands of people that aren't connected, it's not going to be one entity. So we've been organizing here in Kansas City with both civic and corporate leaders as well as the general public. We're pretty much grant-funded, funded by contributions, and we've had some self-generated income through IT support for nonprofits and our computer refurbishing operations.
Let me ask you one headache question there, Michael. How many computers have you sold?
Last year, we put out over 600. They all came in through donations and went through our shop.
Right, right. And how many mesh networks?
We have set up a total of four mesh networks right now that supply free internet to about 500 families.
And do you have a customer support line when those families have problems doing something on their refurbished computer?
Actually, we've had very little need for that. We try to train people very thoroughly, and our customer support essentially is bring your computer in and we will give you a different one.
All right, and you haven't had much problem with that?
No, and I think it's because, you know, we try to keep very quality machines out there. Probably, you know, 30% of the computers that we get actually go to the public, 70% goes to recycling. So we feel, you know, even though these may be low-income families, they deserve as best as we can give them as far as the quality of the machines.
Michael Limantaw is president and co-founder of Connecting for Good, a nonprofit that works to bridge that digital divide in Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks so much, Michael.
Good to be with you.
So building up our communities, how do we create a better home for everyone? Today we're talking about the destructive forces of addiction. You're telling us about friends and family members and personal stories about dealing with addiction in everyday life. From Washington, my friend OD'd in January, just weeks before Philip Seymour Hoffman. Such a sad situation. With every loss, the use of heroin is so dedicated to actually be willing to take an illicit drug intravenously. The signs of addictive behavior must be recognized and addressed. We're so sorry for your loss. We want to hear all your thoughts. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
The plaintive voice of a solo clarinet here in our studio calling out, "Is everyone all right this morning?" it seems to say. That is the question Syrian composer Kinan Azma asks himself every morning. Is his house in Damascus okay? His family and friends, are they all right? Because sometimes there is no answer to that question. So he wrote this piece, A Sad Morning, Every Morning. Azmet was trained in Damascus and at Juilliard, and he recently performed this piece at Carnegie Hall along with the famous Shostakovich Leningrad Symphony, also written for people trapped in wartime. Azmet's life and work has been a journey to discover the power and limitations of art in confronting violence and war.
The piece, you know, you get up in the morning here in New York, the day has already passed in Damascus, you know, we're seven hours after. And, you know, the first thing you do, you open your computer and you hear the terrible news coming from home. So it became really a sad morning every morning. And it reflects, you know, what people are going through. Am I able to really experience what they do experience on the ground? Of course not. But that's the way I can react to it. That's the only thing I can do. You know, I took time of silence for a year before I was able to write music again, because I was questioning the role of the artist, the role of music, if music can stop a single bullet at any time. Of course it doesn't, but what it can do is it can inspire. It's also some kind of therapy also for me to just be able to, you know, to speak out, because I think music is an act of freedom by default in a way.
When you stepped away from music, when you became silent, why did you have to be convinced that music was a symbol of liberation? What was it that made you skeptical?
What I did, I didn't step away from music altogether. I stepped away from actually writing music. I mean, I continued playing because that's what I do. That's what I love doing. And I owe it to myself to keep playing. But, you know, there are different school of thoughts. One of them talks about the role of the artist as somebody who, you know, reflect on the world around him or her. Other school of thought says that the artist's role is to recreate the world in an ideal way. I never believed in neither camp. I think my philosophy is that we do music or we do art in general to experience emotions that we don't have the luxury of experiencing in real life. But then, since March 2011, I found myself experiencing emotions that I have not experienced before. So why do music? I was trying to take it all in and really understand and reflect. And somebody who does abstract music, in a way, without lyrics, you need time to reflect and to think before you're able to reproduce what you have experienced. I'm more than ever actually committed to what an artist can do. I mean, back to the concert we did in Carnegie a few weeks ago, you wonder, is that going to change anything? But, you know, playing for all these fabulous people who came on stage and also in the audience, if we are able to inspire one person in that audience, I think it's great. It's about being proactive, you know. We can talk about the optimism or the lack of for a long time, but being proactive is something that is good for everybody. And maybe we inspired one person in the audience to donate money for the Syrian refugees or whatever small act it can be. I think it can be helpful.
Is optimism generated by art something of an opiate? It just sort of provides an escape for a moment. And is that something that you think is inappropriate, that people should be reminded? Not allowed to forget?
I don't think so, because when you look at Syria in the last 3 years, the amount of art that came out of Syria, of the country, actually is tremendous. And I'm not talking about only art that is reflecting sadness. There's some great, you know, humor that is also coming out of there. Art continues. Art is alive. People keep doing what they're doing, and they have to express. Is it an escape? I don't think of it as a negative escape. It's you owe it to yourself, again, to be playing, and you owe it to the world to keep your voice as loud as possible.
You're obviously grateful for the freedom that you had in Syria and the extent to which it allowed you to become a musician, to come here. Is this song, in a sense, you giving back?
I'm giving back to the country. It's a reflection of what home is. That's what the piece is for me. I don't want to give the piece more symbolism than it is. It's basically a little prayer for home, maybe. I owe it to myself to just play. The piece just came to me. But it's not only about me. It's about lots of people who were not able to achieve their dreams back home.
Do you have a home?
It's a complicated issue. I mean, home is definitely Damascus, but also it extends. It's Damascus, it's Syria, it's the Arab world, it's the world altogether. You know, I always question home. Is home the place you grew up? Is it the place where you have your friends and family, or is it the place where you live? And I think home is the place that you feel you want to contribute to without justifying it. And So home is the mask. But in the meantime, I feel very much at home in New York. When I started my band, for example, in New York, that was for me also a statement kind of thing. Like, okay, I'm finding also home elsewhere. I feel equally at home in Damascus, but also in New York.
There's a Damascus in your mind.
Absolutely.
That will stand in for home.
Oh, absolutely, of course. You know, I have a little house in Damascus. Like, when everything was happening, I kept going to Damascus until July 2012. Not for playing, I was not able to play anymore, but... And I, you know, everybody, the country was, you know, going through what it's going now, and I was busy, like, just painting my house. Just, I was claiming the space, like, this is mine, I'm not going to let anything take that away from me.
What does it look like, that space?
It's a tiny little, I mean, if you think of a one-bedroom apartment in New York, but it's in two floors, it's tiny, it's in the old city. It's the place where I sleep the best, if that makes any sense.
And nearby, a place to get bread.
Of course.
Groceries.
Of course, just like across the street. Yeah.
And you can smell it in the morning.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And smell the coffee from coming from the neighbors.
Do you think you'll ever have that again?
I do. I mean, I'm trying to keep the optimism that I have. Again, history moves forward, and the right thing is about to happen.
So you may be old enough to remember when the Berlin Wall fell. There was this great moment when cellist Rostropovich played amidst the rubble at Brandenburg Gate on his cello. He just went there, sat down, and played. To some, it is the most arresting image of the end of the Cold War.
Absolutely.
And it was an artist, a solo, unaccompanied artist. Do you think there will be such a moment in Syria?
I think there are actually moments like that happening. I mean, like I just saw recently a video, a really inspiring video of musicians who are playing in Mukhayam Liarmouk. This is the camp in the outskirts of Damascus that was sieged actually for a long time, and people did play music. There is still music happening. If we don't know about it, that's another thing. But there are, yes, that's a long answer for your question. Yes, there will be moments, and there are moments happening right now. If I can do it, I would love to do it. Of course, it's a risk. If I assemble the clarinet now in the streets of Damascus, I might be shot because this looks like a weapon too. Actually, maybe it is a weapon.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kenan Azmeh was part of a group of musicians who recently performed at Carnegie Hall as part of a Doctors Without Borders benefit called Shostakovich for the Children of Syria. It was hosted by a nonprofit called Music for Life International. Artist Kenan Azmeh thinks about home in a land at war. The difficulty of holding on to home. Art is the white knuckles of people holding on and trying to keep their homes. Where is home for you? Do you think art is a weapon? We began this hour with a diplomat telling people to leave their homes, and we leave you with an artist who can never leave home. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.